Hello and welcome to the fifth broadcast of RadioFreeErica.net. It is Saturday, August 28th, and it is nearly 1 o'clock. My announcements are that my good friends Amy and Joe Sullivan had their baby, Emily, yesterday. That's the biggest thing. And then I'll talk about today's broadcast, but I also want to say that unfortunately it seems that the web page is not functioning right at this moment, so hopefully people will be able to get through and listen in today, because we have a great day. First, we'll be talking briefly to Lori Novak at the March for Women's Choice across the Brooklyn Bridge, and then we'll be talking to the artist Joy Garnett about her painting in the Watch What We Say exhibition, as well as her other projects. And then we will be speaking to the artist Ann Messner about her project, her newspaper project for Unconventional Heroes that's in the Watch What We Say exhibition. And then we will be talking to Esther Barlev in Israel to hear outside perspectives in. And then we will talk to Wade and Mary Adams today. I'm going to check the phone.
Hello, you're on Radio Free Erica.
Hi, it's Lori calling from the Midwest.
Hi, Lori.
Hi, Lori. It's amazing. There's so many people here that it's already been going on for an hour, and we're not even close to the bridge.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It's really fantastic. There's people of all different ages and amazing signs. Can you hear the drums?
I can't hear the drums, no.
I'm gonna hold the phone out for a second. Did you hear?
I do hear them. That's great.
So we have a good spot. We're behind the drums. It's really amazing how many people there are out here.
That's excellent. So, who are you with?
I'm with Nancy Barber of Florida, Nancy Bowen, and Janet Howard, Jen Wilson, Nancy Miller, and Janet Gray. If anybody wants to stay on the air, I'm on Radio Free Erica right now. About the mic. Nancy just bought a great t-shirt. It says Cheney, but the E's are Enron. It's very nice.
I had a book that had the F was awesome.
Did you buy that?
No,
we've
got
it.
Yeah,
it was done. And then she talked about a nice, it says, Well Behaved Women, Really Great Sisters.
Yeah, excellent.
And Bullshit. What was the other one you got there? It's great.
We're about to enter the bridge. It's taken us an hour, and how are there so many people?
There's so many people here that it's taken us almost 2 hours to even approach the bridge.
That's excellent. That's great. And so, is it mainly women?
No, it's all family, women of all ages.
There's a lot of very, many young
girls. A lot of family.
Uh-huh.
A lot of ladies wearing pasties, which is pretty cute. You know, it's a real mixed crowd. It reminds me of the crowd that went to Washington.
Excellent.
And it's absolutely couldn't be friendlier with the tribe. It's completely genteel people. So wait, I'll pass this on.
Anybody else?
Yes, please.
Not
together.
But Nancy's got a great
I'm sorry.
She got a bumper sticker that says, "The only bush I trust is my own."
Yeah.
She's going to put that on her car.
Excellent. Thank you so much for calling in. It sounds great.
So we'll call back. When we get onto the bridge, we'll call back.
Okay, I'm going to be talking to artists until about 2 o'clock.
Okay, I thought we won't even be across the the break at the office for many people.
Okay, and if I have a break, I'll call you too.
Okay,
great.
Okay.
Thanks, Lori.
Bye.
And that was Lori Novak and Nancy Bowen and some other artists at the March for Women going across the Brooklyn Bridge today. It's really exciting to think about that march happening the day after yesterday was the mob march, the Mothers Oppose Bush. So mothers marching from one day to the next for the right to the choice to be mothers and as mothers. Oh, all leading up to tomorrow, and I guess today I'm feeling a little bit sorry for myself because I'm sitting in this room and there's all of this stuff going on, and I feel conflicted about whether I should be out marching with Lori or I should be in here. And then to discover, and then I told myself that it's much more important to be broadcasting so people from other parts of the country who really just can't be out marching can get an idea of what's going on. And well, it was just disheartening to find that the website is not up for whatever reason today for people to be able to log on. So anyhow, we're going to move in to calling Joy Garnett and
talking to her about In the Watch What We Say exhibition.
You reached the voicemail of Joy Garnett. Please leave a message and I'll try and get back to you. Or call 212-473-6330, where you will reach my other voicemail. Thanks.
Please leave your message after the tone. Press 1 to send a numeric page.
Hi, Joy. It's Erica DeVries calling from the radio. I don't know if I'm going to see if I have another phone number for you. Otherwise, can you give me a call at 718-692-4571? Maybe you forgot because we scheduled today a while ago. Alright, looking forward to speaking to you. Bye-bye. And I have a slot until 1:30, then I'm going to be calling Ann Messner. So if you get a chance, give me a call back before then. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Alright, so now to find in the archives that are my if I have a number. Don't have her other number. Okay. So at 1:30 we'll be calling Ann Messner and hopefully we'll hear from Joy before then. Until that happens, actually, I don't have my essay that I've been reading bits of every day next to me because I took them all with me to the gallery yesterday, and so my table, my broadcasting center, is not as organized as it had been. I am going to actually walk across the room and get that. The only thing is I have to unhook myself from my various headphones, headsets, and we'll have quiet moments. So maybe I'll sing a song. Poorly, I'm sure. Kookaburra sits in the old gum tree, merry, merry king of the bushes, he laugh, kookaburra laugh, kookaburra gay your life must be. Kookaburra sits in the old gum tree, eating all the gum drops he can see. Stop, kookaburra, stop, kookaburra leaves them there. stop, kookaburra stop, kookaburra leaves some there for me. These are the songs I sing to my kid. Stealing robin, red breast, crow flying round, nuthatch hopping down the street, chickadee-dee-dee-dee-dee. Caw, 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 chickadee-dee-dee, chickadee-dee-dee. Robin, red breast, crow flying round, nuthatch hopping down the tree, chickadee-dee-dee-dee-dee. Caw, 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 chickadee-dee-dee, chickadee-dee-dee. Wow, okay. Today is a technically bizarre day. I'm just discovering all sorts of things about what's going on here. And so, I guess I'll read a little bit more from Bruzy and Willie by Gertrude Stein, and this is chapter 13, and I am kind of pulling this just randomly because, in all honesty, I thought I was over-programmed for the day, so I didn't prepare much to read. I thought there were too many things to talk about. So, Willie, said Bruzy, it's serious. Sure it's serious, said Willie. What? Our country, said Bruzy. Sure it's serious, said Willie. You mean pioneering? She was cute, that Pauline, about wilderness and pioneering. Didn't you think she was cute, Bruzy? Didn't you? She is cute, Bruzy, that Pauline. I guess I'll like to see her real often. Yes, I would, Bruzy. But I guess I will and find out more about her pioneering. She's cute, Bruzy, Willie, said Bruzy. It's serious. Yes, I know, Bruzy. Yes, I know. All right, it's serious. But you don't, any of you, say what to do. All you say, what's the matter and everything is the matter, but you don't say what to do. Thinking is what you do, Bruzy, but living is what we all got to do. Switching connections. Now what are we going to do? How are we going to live? Well, said Bruzy, if I'm right, they mostly are not going to live. Sure, you're right, Bruzy, but they mostly are going to live. That's it. That's the funny part of it. They mostly do go on living. Look at the Limeys. You're right, how poor they are, and all at once they were so rich and all. But they don't die. They just keep on, all of them, just going on living. That's the trouble with everything, Bruzy. That's the real trouble with everything. Somehow everybody just does keep on living. Look at everybody over here. By rights, they all ought to be dead. All of them, over and over again, dead. All of them, and they ain't, Bruzy. They ain't at all dead. Far from it, from being all dead. They seem, from the looks of them, to be more of them living than ever were living before. So many more of them. Just look at them. Everywhere is lousy with them. And they all ought to be dead, but they don't die. That is not more than natural. Some more, but not really enough more to make it really matter. No, Bruzy, that's really the trouble with all the thinking. That's the real trouble. Sure, you're right, and some get rich and more get poor, and some go ahead and some go behind, but all the same, they all go on living. And so, Bruzy, well, that is it. Sure, you're right, and if we go on like this, well, yes, we will get poor like the Limeys. Get poor, somebody else will get rich like we were rich. Sure, Bruzy, you're right, but in the kind of way we don't die. We'll all just somehow go on living. That's it, Bruzy. That's it. That is what the matter. That is what is the matter with thinking. That's it. No matter what does happen, everybody somehow goes on living. And there's always seems to be a lot more of them, lots more than anybody needs, but they all go on living. Yes, said Donald Paul. That is what William James called the will to live. Yes, it is, said Willie. I don't know the guy, but that's what it is. They just do go on living. You can't kill them off. Don't you make any mistake about that. Atom bombs or potato bugs or concentration camps or religion or poverty or no jobs or education. It does not make it go any other way. They just do go on living. They don't disappear. The lousy foreigners, how many of them? God knows how many of them there are, but more than ever. I never saw them before, but I certainly am fixed to know that there are more of them living than ever. More than ever. That's what I say. More of them than ever. So that's by Gertrude Stein. It's from Druzy and Willie. That was chapter 13. This is chapter 14. Yes, Willie, said Druzy. Yes, but you got to think anyhow, can you, said Willie. When you are all kind of set that way, can you really make yourself go on when you are all kind of set to get backward? I've been reading a book, said John. Well, well, said Willie. And here they come, that is, here they are. Listen, sister, this guy has been reading a book. Well, and if he has, so have I, said Janet. I've been reading a book about Susan B. Anthony. And who, said Joe, might that dame be? She's the one, said Janet, that made women vote and have the right to money they earn and to their children. Before she came along, women were just like Negroes, before they were freed from slavery. You can say what you like, but she was pretty wonderful, and if she was, said Willie. Yes, I know, said Janet, but the real thing is that she started to do all this because of the Depression. My God, what Depression, said Joe. The Depression of 1838. Now, who of all of you ever knew about that? Not even Bruzy, you know, said Janet. We all think we had the one and only Depression, but they began having them in 1838. Just think of that, over 100 years ago, when America first started. Well, said Jimmy, but there was no industrialism then, just wilderness and pioneering. Hey, Pauline. No, no, said Janet, and that's what is funny. There was industrialism, and it commenced so hard, and they had wildcat banking, and poof, up went the industries. Nobody had any money to buy, just like that, just like now. Her father, he was well-to-do. He went bust. She had to go to work, and she found how little a woman had for her own. A married woman couldn't even have her own money. And so she began to make a noise. Now, said Janet, we got to make a noise, a loud noise, a big noise. We got to be heard. Who's we, said Willie. We are all we, said Janet, all of our age, all together. We got to make a noise. My name is Lawrence, said Lawrence. Now, is it, said Joe. How do you know it is? Well, it is, said Lawrence, and I got something to say. She's right. Not that it'll do anything, but she's right. The trouble with us is we are being ruled by tired middle-aged people. Tired businessmen, the kind who need pinups, you know, the kind only they can afford the originals, not the ones we get. Well, I tell you, said Lawrence, I tell you, here in Europe they are ruled by the young or by the old, and by God they are right. Young ones can make fools of themselves, that's all right, and old ones, if they are old enough to be really old, they got the energy of being old. But I tell you, and my name is Lawrence, and I tell you old and young are better than tired middle-aged. Nothing is so dead, dead tired, dead every way as middle-aged. But we have the guts to make a noise while we are still young before we get middle-aged, tired middle-aged. No, we haven't, said Willie, and you know it. No, we haven't, said Willie. What's the matter, said Willie. Well, it kind of makes me cry, said Pauline. What makes you cry, said Willie. Well, the way you said we hadn't got enough to make ourselves heard, it does make me cry. Yeah, but we have. But have we, said Willie. Well, said Pauline, it does kind of make me cry. So Bruising Willie is written by Gertrude Stein after her work and interviews that she did with U.S. GIs in Paris during the Second World War. And, yeah, it's, for me, on another reading, it's again one of those reminders of now is then again. So, I guess we'll try calling in to Mary Adams and see what she has to share with us today.
making sure she's going to...
Hello, you've reached Mary Adams at 138 Ludlow Street.
I'll try her at home also.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Mary. It's Erica.
Hi, Erica.
Oh, you're on the radio.
I was thinking that probably might be true.
We're having kind of a crazy technical day.
Well, you sound better today. I can hear you. I couldn't hear you at all yesterday.
Yeah, that's better, but... the website is down for some reason, so I think people probably have a hard time logging on today.
I guess so.
Yeah, and
they can't, can they?
Well, they can if they've been on before and they know the direction, but if they haven't been on before, they can't. And then also, it's just an interview an artist at 1:10, and I think she must have forgotten, so she wasn't home. So anyhow, it's been a little off for me. How's your day been so far?
Well, so far it's been good. My neighbors didn't keep me up last night, so I got a good night's sleep. And I spent the morning reading the New York Times. And it had relentlessly good coverage on everything that's going on, which was really fun to read, all the different protests in the Metro section and different articles about people that are, like this one guy is renting a van and picking up people that he contacted through the web who wanted to go to New York to march from, he's leaving Texas, Templeton, Texas, and picking up people on the way.
Wow, good for him.
I know, isn't that cool? So they're driving nonstop.
Wow.
And then there was the big protest of the bicycle people, which was 5,000 people last night.
And where was that?
It was right here.
Oh, wow.
Somehow, 7th Avenue and 14th is like, they started at Union Square. And it's actually a group that cycles once a month to protest cars and the importance of bikes and stuff. But they did this as a special protest. And I guess, there was like 5,000 bikes. That almost seems impossible.
That's great.
Of course, 100 people got arrested or more.
That was the only thing I had heard.
Yeah. But, they rode, where did they go from? Union Square up 8th Avenue, I think. Oh, I can't find it right now. But anyway, and then the picture of the bicycle riders, it just so happens that the woman and the woman's daughter that I work with at the girls' club, Lou, is in the picture.
Oh, that's great.
That's so funny, I think.
Oh, that's so great.
It's so funny that out of all the 5,000 people that they would be in the picture.
Fantastic.
I know. And what else? There's pictures of the people that dropped the big banner off the Plaza Hotel. So they did interviews pretty much with all the people that have gotten in trouble or that are coming to protest. And there was also an interview of the celebrities that are being called upon to, go to a lot of the Democratic functions and how they're, like, exhausted from doing so much. And MoveOn had a big thing for John Kerry up at the Hammerstein Ballroom. That was a big hit, and lots of people were there, I guess. And so anyway, I spent the morning reading the paper, and it was kind of exciting to read all that stuff because, like I said, I can't quite imagine all these people coming to town.
Yeah.
And half the people are leaving town, but I guess they really are.
Yeah.
So it'll be kind of exciting tomorrow to see what is going to be going on.
Are you going to be on the radio tomorrow, or are you going to be marching?
Well, that's a conundrum, and I had decided that it was more important to be broadcasting so people who really couldn't physically be here could listen in and just spend the whole day calling in to people at the march.
Good idea.
Yeah, but if the website isn't working, then I feel a little bit like I'm in a vacuum. But then maybe archiving it is, you know, worthwhile also.
Can't you come on the march with a microphone?
I can, but I can't broadcast live at the same time. So I'm still thinking about it, but I had committed to doing the radio show.
So. Yeah. Well, that's a good idea to have people call in and
Yeah, who will you be with tomorrow? Does somebody have a cell phone?
Yes.
Yeah?
They will.
Do you have my cell phone number?
Yes, I do, but I better take it. Oh, you can't give it to me over the thing.
Yeah, I can. Because I gave it out to people to call in.
Okay.
It's 917-414.
917-414?
0276.
0276. Okay, so I guess I'll call you from the...
Yeah, that'd be great.
...the march. And did you get the website of the Klugman that did the Democratic?
No.
You didn't?
No. Did you email it to me?
It's on. My brother sent it, but he made it sound like he sent you one, too.
Okay.
I didn't hear what you said about my brother yesterday.
Oh.
Or that he sent you. I thought he sent you something.
No.
I didn't
say anything disparaging about your brother.
Oh, I know. I could barely hear you, and I knew you had said something, but I didn't hear what it was, and I thought it was something about that website.
No, I think just that I got emails from people saying how much they enjoyed his segment.
Oh, okay. I'll send the website to you so that you can broadcast it and people can look it up.
Great.
Because it's a really good spot about the future and changing not only the Republicans but the Democratic platform into a more acceptable balance of things.
Right.
But
I know that's the thing. That's the thing I keep. I'm like, this is so fantastic, all this momentum. But geez, Louise, even if Carrie wins, we need to keep it up. Like the celebrities need to stay exhausted. Like we need some serious change.
Yeah, and the Democratic Party needs serious change also.
Yeah, absolutely.
The power of money is in our government and is just way too much right now. It's totally corrupted our whole system.
Yeah, and all our global police system.
Yeah, and to tell you the truth, I can't really tell if Carrie's plan's all that much different.
Oh,
In the global, you know,
yeah.
policies. Like, his Mideast policy is not really that different, which is very disturbing, I think.
Right.
Because I find it encouraging and inciting terrorism more than the opposite. So that's kind of a little bit on the frightening side, but hopefully if he... I mean, the whole thing about the money and the lobbies that influence people to make decisions by money and who's going to vote for them rather than what is right is really really out of proportion right now and frightening, I think. And it's not about the people anymore. It's about money.
No, absolutely.
The root of all evil. So, anyway... well, I don't know if I have anything else to say.
All right, well, thanks so much. So that was a lot, and it's good to hear you feeling a little more lively again. You've been sounding like you are...
I didn't sleep two nights in a row.
Yeah.
I know I was very articulate yesterday, so...
No, you're very articulate. You just sounded a little down on the whole thing. I just have to say that I talked also at the beginning of the program with some artists who are at the pro-choice march that's going across the bridge, and they were very pumped up with enthusiasm.
Oh, the moms?
No, the moms were yesterday, and today is the the pro-choice.
Although
I'm sure there are plenty of moms at this one, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they, how many people were there?
Oh, she just said that there were so many people there that the march had started over an hour ago and they still hadn't made it to the bridge.
Oh, wow.
So
maybe tomorrow is going to be monster huge.
Oh, it's going to be monster huge.
Because all those people are going to come again, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Oh, sure. Tomorrow's going to be monster huge. It's going to be everybody from all the little ones together.
Wow.
So,
I can't imagine they're dispersing at Union Square, the poor little park.
I know. The grass at the park.
And that's when they're going up to the other park.
Yeah.
So that we worry about the grass.
Yeah.
Well, I read an article a while ago on the woman. There's a woman that takes care of the Great Lawn. And it was a very interesting article to even think about one person really overseeing the whole, you know, making sure the grass is green and kept green and how to keep it shifting, you know.
Yes.
From where people sit to they don't sit. And I just think she must be in great turmoil now. And I feel sorry for the grass, too.
Yeah.
And so in that part, I feel kind of ambivalent about everybody going to the park. But I guess it's going to happen anyway, some way or another. Everybody's going to end up there, it sounds like. So hopefully that woman's got a good idea of how to bring it all back to life.
Yeah.
So anyway. All right, so I'll call you tomorrow. I don't know if it'll be exactly at 1. Should I try to call you right at 1?
Well, I think I'm just going to be, like, calling out and waiting for calls to come in. So just call, and I'll try and pick up, you know, unless somebody's in the middle of saying something important.
Right.
So.
Okay.
Okay, great.
Have a good day.
Yeah, thanks, Mary. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So that was Mary Adams. She has a dress shop on the Lower East Side, and she's been talking to me every day, talking about her commute from Chelsea to the Lower East Side and what she sees happening in the city as the convention gears up and the protests gear up. And she's just also talking about what she's reading and hearing and those sorts of things. So next, I'm going to call the artist Anne Messner, who's in the Watch What We Say exhibition. She has a newspaper in it which is designed for the unconventional heroes. She's a member of the Artist Network of Refuse and Resist.
Hello.
Hi, Anne. This is Erica. We're on the radio.
Hi. Are we on the radio already?
We're on the radio already.
Oh, well, I'm doing my dishes.
Okay.
I guess I better stop.
You multitasking, doing three things at once.
No. Are we really on the radio?
We really are.
Okay. Well, I'm rinsing.
Okay. How
I
are
just
you?
Have to finish this.
How are you today?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. I just had a call in from some women that are at the pro-choice march coming across the bridge.
Yeah, in the rainy day, right?
The rainy day?
That's what the media was. There were just all these emails coming out yesterday and the day before. Oh, what if it gets rained out and there's not a cloud in the sky?
Right,
so
right.
I'm not really a conspiracy theorist, but I wonder who's working for the weather station.
All right. Well, they're always wrong anyway. They've been
That's
wrong.
That's for tomorrow also, that it's going to rain.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, so.
So I was hoping you could start just by describing the piece that you have in the exhibition,
mm-hmm.
The Unconventional Heroes piece, and for people who, because I imagine most of the listeners are people who can't actually see the exhibition. So.
Right. Especially since it's only open for 1 week.
Right. And right.
Okay, well, first thing, I have to clear my throat. So
okay.
I'm going to cover the mouthpiece. Hold on. Okay. Did you see the work?
Yes, I did. I haven't had a chance to read through the whole thing.
Right, it's a bit of a read.
Yes.
It's paper. Okay, so for the audience who hasn't seen it, I have in the exhibition Watch What We Say, it's a newspaper vending machine, like the type that you see on street corners that dispense the, specifically New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, that type. And the paint's been stripped off it, and it's been outside for a while, for actually two previous projects. So it's nicely patinaed, rusty. And I have an etched sign on the nameplate where normally there's the amount of money in the little money slot, the coin slot, that says Unconventional Heroes. It's etched into the plate. And inside the machine, available for free, is a 24-page paper that is titled Unconventional Heroes. And it is a document that consists of interviews and photographs with 9 people. And these 9 people, what they have in common is that each one has just recently received the 2004 Courageous Resister Awards that were presented by Artist Network of Refuse and Resist. I've got to clear my throat again. Sorry. There's a lot of smog in the air today. Okay, so 9 Courageous Resisters. Are you still there?
Yes.
You just want me to keep talking?
Yeah, I guess my question is, has this award been given before in the past?
Yeah. Refuse and Resist has been, let me see if I'll get this right, has been giving, and not on a regular basis, on an irregular basis, the Courageous Resister Awards. I believe since, I could be wrong, the middle 80s, for more than a decade.
Okay.
And sometimes they're given just individually to one person and sometimes and to several people at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
What I think was markedly different about this time is that the awards were presented on a big stage.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, 2 nights ago on August 26th at the Skirball Center for the Performing Arts at NYU.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an evening of performance to honor these Courageous Resisters who were all there. Actually, there were even more there. We had 11 there, some previous recipients, and each one spoke briefly. It was quite a moving evening.
Yeah.
I could proceed to tell you who the individuals were and what they did.
Sure.
I don't know. You're interviewing me.
I'm interviewing you, but I'm also, a big part of this project is hearing what other people have to say, as much more so than what questions specifically I have. So, So if something feels more important to talk about, then definitely. The things I'm interested in are your work in the project. You, as a visual artist, had a specific role in designing this.
Well, yeah, I did. I think the newspaper to complement and exist on its own, as a self-sustaining document to these awards and that one event was my idea.
Mm-hmm.
And the form was my idea of the interviews with the images of the Resister's Choice. They were asked to give an image, a photograph that spoke to the particularity of what their resistance was about. I have to say that also the timing of both the awards and this project of the newspaper, you know, obviously has to do with the focus in New York at this time
right.
of the Republican National Convention
right.
and the all the multitude of issues of questions that are surfacing, and we, the resistors, these particular nine people, that the areas in their lives that they've concerned themselves with have to do, you know, for instance, not just with the war issue, but a multiple of issues. So it was the intention to, well, we don't cover every issue, but it's sort of multifaceted. And then the form of the newspaper, you know, it is a public form. It's what, it's commonplace on street level. You know, newspapers are read on the street. You know, they're bought on the street. People read them coming and going from work. And oftentimes they're purchased out of newspaper machines. Now I have to say that the, that my vending machine that's now in the exhibition, once the exhibition's over, is moving to the street.
Oh, yeah.
And it'll be at some corner, not yet designated, where it'll have a longer and a more public life outside of a sort of bracketed art exhibition
right.
on political art.
Oh, great.
So, anyway, so that's why specifically now, and then the form of the work. I have done other newspapers, and the newspaper vending machine I have used before for another project of mine, which I don't really want to get into. So it's not an unusual form for me as a visual artist. And I also have come out of a tradition of doing public work. So it's pretty much along in the venue of my work. And then the specific subject matter, the more sort of social intention of the subject matter is not foreign to my work.
Mm-hmm.
It's very common. Well, I guess I'd like to get into the specifics of who these people, these nine people.
Okay, great. Did you do the interviews yourself, or some of them? I think.
Yeah, they're nine interviews.
Mm-hmm.
They're nine people. I did three of them,
mm-hmm.
and in the interest of time, and there wasn't that much time. This was put together over a 2-week period.
Wow.
And
wow.
It is not a perfect document. It would have been nice to have a proofreader.
Right, right.
But it was put together very rapidly.
That's impressive.
Sort of on the fly.
Yeah.
But I think, actually, that it looks fine, considering that it was a 2-week period. There was one other person interviewing who ended up, and I ended up, you know, we sort of shared that. I guess, having to do it again, I would do all the interviews
mm-hmm.
because I found that, well, it doesn't matter why. I would do them all. But I did do the transcription. There was somebody who read through the full transcripts and edited them down to the form of one page.
Mm-hmm.
So the material's edited. And again, the interviews center around the particular subject matter of why these people were given the Courageous Resistor Awards. And I'll just go through the list very quickly. I'll talk quickly, and I won't get really into depth. Some of the people are people wouldn't know about if they knew the news, if they paid attention to the news. Some people are more obscure but have to do with topics that I think that many of us are concerned about, think about, or perhaps if we're not, we might begin to consider. The first is Michael Berg. And I'm going alphabetically because I'm looking at a list. Michael Berg, who is the father of Nicholas Berg, who was one of the first, he was the person who was working for the United Nations in Iraq, loosely for the United Nations. He was working, putting up cell phone towers, communication towers in Iraq, who was kidnapped and then beheaded. And his father, Michael Berg, is a staunch anti-war activist and has become, since Nicholas's death, very, very outspoken against the administration's policy in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things about the courageous resistors is that there's a certain circumstance is that something happens in their, first off, they're ordinary people. Something happens in their life that goes against what they think either ethically, morally, politically, a variety of reasons, but that they feel very strongly about, and they take a stance. And in taking their stance, they meet opposition. But they don't back down to the opposition and continue to take their stance, which not only makes them resistors, but makes them very courageous.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, and they all have this in common, that they've all really faced a certain difficulty in standing up for what they believe in. And it was our intention, the Artist Network of Refuse and Resist, and part of the historical intention of the Courageous Resistor Awards is to help support these people because they need the support. So, for instance, with Michael Berg, he received a tremendous amount of very, very public criticism on his anti-war stance, you know, through the right-wing radio, and he just really, really was rebuked. But he continued with that anti-war stance, even in the face of the tremendous personal grief mm-hmm. that both he and his family were faced with. There's Rachel Corey, was one of the recipients, who was the woman from, the young woman from Washington who had gone to Rafah in the West Bank to, with the international solidarity movement, to try to prevent the bulldozing and of homes and destroying of wells, water wells. In the border town, border city, I don't know, city, town of Rafah, and she was, you know, crushed by an Israeli bulldozer.
Mm.
And so she received an award, and her parents actually received the award for her.
Mm.
Now, the award was given to Rachel Corey,
right.
But her parents, Craig and Cindy, have, since her daughter's death, have gone to the occupied territories, have been to Rafah, have met with peace activists on both Palestinian and Israelis, and have really, really taken on Rachel's commitment.
Mm-hmm.
So, the award was given to Rachel, but I have to say her parents are really inspirational.
Yeah, it's pretty
incredible. And then there is a person, Bill Keyes, from Madison, Wisconsin, who refused to enforce a state law that made it mandatory for students to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. And he was somebody who stood alone on the school board against enforcing that law. This was somebody who national right-wing radio, Rush Limbaugh et al., you know, his home received hundreds and hundreds of blistering, horrible phone calls. But he stood fast to that and in his belief that specifically the under God aspect of the pledge and the type of insistent patriotism was in fact problematic for, I think, Madison, Wisconsin has a quite a multinational, ethnically diverse population, and a lot of people felt had conveyed to him as a member of the school board that they felt uncomfortable. So, and he did not back down. And what's interesting is that he, in the end, actually ended up being voted president of the school board. So the town really rallied. The people really rallied around him in support of his stance. Not necessarily, actually, that they agreed with it, but that they had a huge amount of admiration and trust that of in his conscientious stand. So then, should I go on?
Yeah, that's great. I hadn't heard about the last person,
Bill Keyes. Well, as I said, like some of the people, he actually, Bill Keyes, there was a long article in The New Yorker about him, because this went on for quite a while. All these stories sort of go on for a while and totally disrupt these people's personal lives. And some cases, in a very negative way, but ultimately there is something, well, you know, the Phoenix Rising. Aaron Leibowitz, who he's now not, but he was a senior high school student in Darby, Montana. And he led students and adults to fight against the school board-supported resolution to teach creationism as parallel to evolution in the as part of the school curriculum. And Aaron led, organized a movement. I forget what the name of the organization is that he started. I'm sorry, I just don't remember that. But anyway, it ended up being voted out of the school curriculum. So, and he, when he began, he was the only student who was vocal about it and petitioned and began going to meetings and became, you know, an advocate against the pseudoscience being taught in his school, and apparently, all these people have little stories that they tell, but apparently Aaron, when he would go downtown to Darby, would get hissed at by adults who...
Unbelievable.
Another person is Camilo Mejia, who was actually, in terms of the Iraq War, was the first official CO, conscious objector, to be tried, found truant, and he's now serving a year in jail. And accepting the award for him were his mother and his aunt. Camilo Mejia, I think, you know, I could speak for an hour on the particularities of his story, but what I can say, just to try to say, you know, all of these people I could talk for hours about. I found, you know, through the interviewing and then going through the transcripts and getting photos from them, that they've so much moved me. It's been really, a privilege to get to put together this document, and then to even consider that it's part of my work,
right,
has really been a privilege. But with Camilo, he was on the last 6 months of an 8-year commitment, 3 years in the Army, then 5 years in the National Guard, was in the last 6 months commitment, activated, deployed to Iraq, went to Iraq, was there for several months, and he did witness some things that some people would consider war crimes. But while he was there, applied for conscientious objector status. That was denied. He came back here for 2 weeks' leave because He's not an American citizen. He's a Nicaraguan citizen, and he had to come back to make sure that his papers were in order. And anyway, he was denied the conscientious objector status, so he went into hiding. Ultimately, he did turn himself in. Mm-hmm. And part also what happened to him was that he was in the last 6 months of an 8-year commitment. Hmm. And they did a stop loss on him. And now you're not going to believe what I say because it's not going to sound right, but it's the truth. They did a stop loss on him, and they extended his commitment to the National Guard to the year 2031, which is 25 years, I think, 26, 27, 26. It's a full lifetime. And I know it doesn't sound right.
Well, yeah.
But I double-checked
I'm sure.
Fact-checker, and this is what the National Guard, and I think this is the type of story. First off, he's not an American citizen.
Right.
And he joined the military because he wanted to become a part of this society that he was living in. He moved here when he was 18 because his mom moved here from Nicaragua. And anyway, you know, I could talk really in detail much longer about him. And then there's, should I go on?
Yeah.
We have 5 minutes, right?
Yeah, we have.
This is 30 minutes. Well, I'll just talk.
It's either you can go on because, I mean, this
well,
is
yeah, I think
beautiful.
Actually what I'd like to do, I don't really want to go, you know, there's somebody, Dave Meserve from California. This has to do with the Patriot Act. There's Tony Smith, the basketball player who turned her back to the flag and was really demonized through the mainstream media, mainstream sports media for months.
Mm-hmm.
She played for Manhattanville College, the basketball player. There's Lynn Stewart, the people's public advocate, people's lawyer from New York City, who was the first person who was indicted by the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, under the guise of the Patriot Act. And then Juanita Young, who's become a very strong, a vocal presence against police brutality. Her son, Malcolm Ferguson, mm-hmm. was shot unarmed, point blank, by the NYPD.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so, but I think that if anyone hears this conversation of me now talking to you and is interested in finding out more about who these people were or the paper, well, for one, they can come to the show.
Right. Or the website.
Or they can go, actually, to the Refuse and Resist website. Just do, you know, I think if you do a Google search to Courageous Resisters, Refuse and Resist, or Artist Network of Refuse and Resist, that you can get the information, or, you know, quite honestly, if somebody heard this and wanted to see a copy of the paper and it was after the show, they could email me or call me, and I'd be happy to get them a copy of it. I have a couple hundred copies in my own personal presence, but in Refuse and Resist, it was an edition of 5,000. About half of them are gone now because they're just being given out. The intention was to give them out over the period of this week.
Yeah. Also I think through the exhibition website they can get to your page and from there to the Artist Network site as well.
Yeah, I think my page is from Artist Network.
Yeah. Yes. It's really great to hear you talk about sort of this process. I mean, part of what's been exciting talking to all these different artists is hearing about their process and making their work, and this idea, how you said, it's a privilege to have been doing that project. And I think they're, you know, unconventional heroes. I mean, it's an unconventional way or of thinking, approaching making art and thinking about that process, like pulling other people into what you are doing and sort of
Well, I think I got pulled along with them.
Yes,
it was not so much me pulling them
right.
in, but them pulling me along or me choosing to dive in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think, this is idea of us being an artist who works in one studio or who, might, like, well, I hate the word, but post-studio artists or whatever. I mean, I certainly have and continue to spend a lot of, private time in my studio. I am an object maker. But I think that, that one doesn't have to exclude a sort of a social intention and process through one's work as a visual artist. In this particular case, this project is the sum of all the parts. And I could not have done it alone.
Right.
It wouldn't exist.
Right.
It's a completely different product.
Right.
And there wasn't, it really was a very concentrated 2-week period, and one would have liked to have had a little more time. And a little, perhaps, more help. But I found the entire time that my emotional, clarity. I had a very emotional and intellectual clarity. I don't think at any point it was like, what is this? Why? I don't think that entered it. It was pretty much, oh my God, we don't have that much time. But. That was the problem, was the urgency of the clock kept ticking, but I just felt really humbled the whole time, that because I was so moved emotionally, and then I found that people would go, well, Anne, what are you working on? Because, I was very busy. I couldn't even talk on the phone. And every time I went to describe it, I found that I had a quite emotional pressure, really sort of, behind the words. I would just try to say a couple words and my eyes would water up because I was just so moved about it.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's about them, and having the opportunity to get to tap into, these sort of committed lives. And, it was good. I mean, I'll do it again. I've sort of been back in my studio the last couple of days. It's real quiet there.
Uh-huh.
And, I'm not all that sure.
Right. No, I can imagine it would be a tough transition.
Well, I mean, it's a transition. Mm-hmm. I'm casting bowls, rubber bowls. I'm looking at the rubber bowls saying, the intention is similar, but boy,
yeah.
I think I have to really spin that one.
Yeah. Yeah. Erin, thank you so much for sharing.
Okay.
And it's really great to hear this.
Thank you.
So, are you going to be on the streets tomorrow?
I'm on my way up to Grand Central Station. We have their free speech areas, and we've booked both of them. We're giving out those banners.
Oh.
So I'm out. I'm not in.
Okay.
But not this weekend. I'm not in.
Okay.
So
all
maybe
right.
I'll meet you.
All right. Yeah.
Okay.
Be okay. Well. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was the artist Anne Messner, and we were talking to her about her project that's in the Watch What We Say exhibition up at Schroeder Romero Gallery. The project that she did was in collaboration with the Artist Network of Refuse and Resist, and it is a newspaper that tells the stories of these conscientious, unconventional heroes. So next we're going to be speaking with Esther Barlev in Israel from the Kibbutz Be'eri.
Hello?
Hello, Esther. It's Erica.
Hi, Erica.
We're on the radio.
We're on live?
We're on live, yes.
You mean a few people hear me?
A few people hear you, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. Physically.
Good.
Mentally.
Good.
Okay, that's good enough.
So what's the weather like there on the kibbutz right now?
The weather here is 30 degrees centigrade. That's about 80.
80. And it's what time? About 9 at night?
It's 9 o'clock in the evening.
Uh-huh.
And it's very pleasant for us because during the day it goes up another to 90 and more.
In
the evening, in the Negev, in the southern part near the desert, are pleasant. In the northern part, in Tel Aviv, near the shore, there isn't a difference.
Well, sorry. That was some of the connections. Must have done
okay.
That. Say that again.
It doesn't get so cool in the evening along the coast near the shore and up north. But here in the Negev, near the desert, there's a big difference between the day and the night. So that it gets very nice and cool in the evening, and we're very pleased with that.
Good. And what's growing on the kibbutz these days?
Well, the fields around us, they're really the end of the wheat season, and they're beginning to sow a new season for wheat and potatoes. Things like that. We don't have in our area, we don't have vegetables and things that are labor intensive. In our area, they're mostly grains, potatoes, things that are all mechanized, can be sown and reaped and harvested all with machines.
Uh-huh. And
because we don't have the people who will do that work these days, you know.
Right.
From agriculture, you can't make a living.
Right.
Unless it's heavily subsidized, and our government isn't subsidizing the agriculture these days. So my kibbutz really earns its living with the printing press. It's a plant, a printing plant that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And that's doing very well.
Good. And where does the agricultural products, where do they come from? Do they come from outside of Israel? Or
Some come from outside of Israel, but mostly in the north.
Mm-hmm.
There are villages, mostly our villages, but also not only. There are a lot that are in greenhouses in the Negev as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really very high intensive, what do you call it, with a lot of manpower for that kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
And people hire laborers for that.
Mm-hmm.
And they do. There are a lot of vegetables and fruits and vegetables around, so it's not a problem getting a lot to eat of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Right now there's a problem because of the barriers in the West Bank, because we used to market most of it. Not most of it, but a lot in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And now there's no, there isn't a free passage because everybody's afraid of bombs being going pass through with the free passage of trucks and things like that.
Uh-huh. And so a lot of the vegetables from Israel would go in or things would come out? I'm sorry.
Both directions.
Right.
And it's very difficult now. I have some friends who have an orchard, a big orchard of peaches and pears, and that's in season now.
Uh-huh.
And they said they can't market it because there are millions in the Gaza Strip, and they're not letting them, the government isn't letting anything pass.
Right.
It's almost at a standstill, you know, this whole business of peace is so difficult for me to digest, and many of us, of course.
Right.
The fact that on the one hand, you know, the soldiers are treating the civilians who wait, because some of them have licenses to come across from the Gaza Strip, let's say, and work in Israel. There's very little work in the Gaza Strip.
Right.
The corruption is so bad there in the Palestinian Authority that it's really impossible to imagine that there could someday be a real democracy and some kind of social security or social anything. It's really terribly upsetting to know what goes on there. And there's very little work there. And some of the people who worked in Israel before, every time there's a bombing, they close the borders.
Right.
So that then they can't come to work. I have a few friends who work in Israel, and I know that they in order for them, when they do get a license and they open the borders for the workers to come, they could stand 3, 4, and 5 hours.
Yeah.
They start from 2 in the morning to be able to get through, because the security is so tight that they examine everyone, all of their identity cards, their whole body. They can't take anything out with them at all.
It's unbelievable. So you can't take any
packages, yeah. Just what they're wearing.
Right.
And so on the one hand, I know, I understand the soldiers. They are really very frightened.
Right.
Because there have been so many incidents of even children. They gave the fanatics gave children bombs to carry across the border, and they exploded with the soldiers as well. So I understand the soldiers on the one hand, and on the other hand, I have a very difficult time knowing that all of those people, in order to get out of the Gaza Strip or the West Bank, can wait hours for all the people to be, checked thoroughly to make sure that nobody's going by with a bomb, and the soldiers themselves are afraid.
Yeah.
The only thing we can hope for is peace. I talk to my friends and I say, okay, let's just hope there's peace. And you know what they say to me usually? They say, you have to make it. We haven't got a democracy. We can't say anything. We're afraid to say anything.
So what do they mean, you have to make it?
That we, the Israelis, have to do that.
Yes. And
how?
Well,
if Bush and Sharon together are playmates, then I haven't got a lot of hope for peace in the near future.
And how do people feel about Kerry?
Well, they don't know him.
Right.
They don't really know him, so I don't know if there's too much to be said about him from here.
Right.
Just what we read in the papers, and I don't know, and I guess we read the polls as well. But you know, we know what Bush is, and we say, okay, for him, Sharon, they're two, what do you call it, bedfellows? Something like that? Is there an expression like that?
Yes,
okay.
Yeah.
And since I don't like Sharon, how can I like Bush?
Yeah.
But I can't say he's bad for Israel.
Right.
I don't know if there would be somebody else instead of Sharon if he would be as good, but probably. There's evidently some feeling of solidarity there. And I guess they really understand that the Palestinian Authority is not what they could count on for building a democracy in the Middle East.
Right.
Okay. Difficult questions we have to handle here.
No, absolutely. I mean, I appreciate you so much that your willingness to talk about them and just talk about what you're talking about with your friends and what they're saying. And I'm part of doing this is to check in with people outside of the U.S., hopefully on a daily basis, but just to kind of see what people are thinking about the elections or local politics or American politics, just to remind ourselves that we're global citizens, not just, you know,
right.
Americans.
Are Right, absolutely. But what I wanted to ask about that is, are you all guys, do you know what's going on in the Olympic Games?
I don't know what's going on. The Olympic Games, I know nothing about what's going on, except that the women's...
Well, that's international.
Yes, you're right, you're right.
And here, everybody is glued to the television.
Yeah.
So the 4 days, or how many days there were, and the fact that, what do you call it, an Israeli got a gold medal in something on, what kind, I don't even know what they call, Mistral something, on the water, on the sea.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what they call those things in English. Not paragliding, I guess. No, not with a parachute. It's on the water,
but it's with a sail. Windsurfing.
Uh-huh. Windsurfing.
Uh-huh.
So Israel got the first gold medal ever. In this Olympic game, everybody here is really very excited. And also, we got a bronze medal in judo, but that we've had before, too, even.
Uh-huh.
The time before and the time before. But for us, it's the first time gold medal. And you know what? We watch the games here avidly. People don't do anything but sit and watch TV for these 4 days. And American just got a gold medal. They're not doing so well this time. But outside of America, it's such a popular thing now.
Oh, it's popular here, too. I just haven't been, you know... It's very popular, you know, I speak to my relatives, they're watching, they say they haven't seen the news in days because they're just watching the Olympics.
I thought it for everybody, you mean you.
No, I mean me.
So I don't sit and watch it, but on the one hand, but I do know, I mean, there was such a big celebration when Israeli got a gold medal. Boy, I mean, everybody was so proud of him.
Yeah.
And you know, they feel this is international stuff going on. People from all over the world getting together to be in sports, hoping that it really has nothing to do with drugs and stuff. Somebody's taking care of that end, I guess. And so here you got something international going, but feeling good.
Yeah, good. Who is that barking in your house?
I'm babysitting my son's dog.
Oh, it's Rose.
Right.
Yeah.
You remember?
Yeah, I remember Rose.
They went on vacation, and I took the dog for a few days, for 4 days, to the kibbutz to babysit.
Uh-huh.
And now she's outside because I wanted to be quiet. I closed the door and then went into her room, so... So we could talk, otherwise the TV is going on and a lot of noise.
So, how do you feel about visiting Israel? Like, what do you think? Is it a time to come or not a time to come or?
Well, it's always a time to come, and my brothers usually come when they can. And people are coming, but I know that it's scary. I mean, I'm thinking to myself, let's say, would I go to Bosnia now for a visit? Who the hell knows what's going on in Bosnia, right?
Right.
So people who don't really know anything about Israel say, I'm not going to Israel. It's dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But those of us who live here, we live our everyday lives. We try to be more careful. I don't know. And certainly when tourists come there, they are guarded on all sides. So, and also they're really cracking down very hard on the terrorists who are, that's why the barriers, that's why they have to wait for so long.
That's why the pairs can't go through.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But, it's been better as far as bombs are concerned, but here where I live, right near the Gaza Strip, and we can hear the shooting. The soldiers are always going in to find the terrorists who are going to send the next missile into the towns around the Gaza Strip. And it stopped. There were a couple of weeks ago, every morning at 7:15, there was a missile fired into Sderot.
Oh my God.
And other places, some of the kibbutzim around. Luckily, in all of the months, 2 people were killed. That's luckily, you know. When you're firing a missile every single morning into a place that's, that people are living, you think, my God, what luck have we had up till now? And then one day, a mother and a baby, a child, going to the kindergarten. They fell near the kindergarten. They were killed. And since then, there have been the Israeli soldiers have been trying to clean out the Gaza Strip from these people. And you know, it's not all the people in the Gaza Strip. I told you, I have these friends. They worked in Berry, and I talked to them on the phone. And they wish it would stop, but they're the terrorists that are the fanatics, and they don't want peace, you know?
No.
They want a peace when they get pieces of Israel.
Right. Well, it seems that it's the fanatics on both sides that...
Always yeah. The fanatics on both sides who don't let us live the normal life.
Yeah.
Some sort of compromise must be arranged or being able to talk to one another. And even with fanatics, you can't talk on all sides. Where do they come from? I agree with that.
Yeah.
Erica, how was the exhibit?
The exhibit's very nice. It's.
I saw the site.
Yeah.
So I got my idea of what it is about.
Yeah, it's. Did you go through the different artist galleries?
Of course.
Yeah,
I did.
No, it's really nice. It's a nice mm-hmm. show. It's a good combination of people approaching social issues from different points of view. Well, not necessarily so much different points of view, but different ways
from
of...
From their own point of view,
but... With different ways of working, but the thing is of course everybody's got similar social concerns and political concerns within it.
Well, tell Mark that as a curator, I think he did a very good job.
Oh, that's nice.
He really looks interesting. And are people visiting?
People are visiting, yeah. He's over there today. There was a blurb in the New York Times yesterday about the show. Mm-hmm. And
oh, good.
Yeah, a few listings in weekly papers and things. So I think it's going to be a busy weekend there. Yeah.
Okay. Good. Well, it's weekend. Today's Saturday. So you have Saturday, Sunday, and tomorrow I start working, so weekend is over right now.
Yes, our weekend, exactly. Tomorrow, though, is the big march. They're expecting possibly up to 1 million people, so that should be interesting, too.
And your radio station?
No radio.
People listening, you're getting people who call in and say, I heard you when you talk.
Yeah, yeah, I'm getting emails from friends that I haven't been in touch with in years and writing in about programs. It is. It's really nice, and it's very exciting to me to get to talk to, you know, you and to talk to other artists in the exhibition and just hear what people are thinking, because I feel like right now, you know, coming from a photography background, a visual background, I don't know how to make the images that talk about the confusion that I have right now. And to me, it's more important to be dialoguing than to be making photographs for myself right now. So that's...
Okay. So I wish you would get that through the confusion, and through your talking to people, you're going to get some... insight into what's really going on, and if you do, tell me, because I'm just as confused.
I know.
Can I ask about your baby?
Of course you can ask about the baby. He's with Carol right now. She's been a goddess to take care of him, so I can do my program, and Mark can be at the gallery, and yeah, he's great.
He's great, growing.
He's growing, and he's running now, and he's doing gymnastics over the furniture, and just like you said, he's taking things apart and trying to put them back together.
That's successfully been taking them apart.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. His favorite thing right now is headphones. He likes to figure out what they can plug into.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
And you're all well, I hope.
Yeah, we're all well. And everybody sends their love and regards. And Carol's looking forward to listening to the program later, because she can't listen to it while she's got the baby. But I told her,
of course not.
I'm archiving
it. Let me start to listen.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Okay, give my love to everyone.
I will.
And thanks for including me in your excitement, because it really makes me excited, too, for you.
Oh, thank you. Good, good. Okay. All right, hello to everybody there.
Right, bye-bye.
All right, bye, Esther.
That was Esther Barlev at the Kibbutz Be'eri in the Negev part of the desert. Esther moved to Israel when she was 18 years old, over 50 years ago now, to help in the kibbutz movement. And she's still living on her kibbutz, and they're doing well. And it's always an inspiration to talk to her about the an inspiration in that that there are people in Israel that are just as confused, just as unhappy about the way all of the peoples in the territories and Israel are being treated. It gives some sense of hope that there can be a change and hopefully peace. So I've just received an email from Wade Nasanovich that we won't be speaking to him today, so I'm going to try to call in to Lori Novak again
at the March for Women's Choice and see if they're on the bridge yet.
Voicemail, leave a message. Thanks.
Please leave your...
I don't think I'll leave her a message. She'll see that I called and maybe she'll give a call back. I'm going to pick something to read, and I think maybe I'll end a little bit early today. I mean, it's been an amazing day in terms of talking to people, but also frustrating in that the website is not up and people are not able to actually get to the stream. The radio show. I'll read a little bit more from the Arundhati Roy come September. Essay. We had just ended with she had been talking about different September anniversaries, and specifically different September 11th anniversaries throughout the world. This is an essay that she originally read in a speech in Santa Fe, New Mexico in the year 2002. She had just spoken about Madeleine Albright's moral equivalence with the killing of children and the bombing of Iraq. A decade of bombing has not managed to dislodge Saddam Hussein, the beast of Baghdad. Now, almost 12 years on, President George Bush Jr. has ratcheted up the rhetoric once again. He's proposing an all-out war whose goal is nothing short of a regime change. The New York Times says that the Bush administration is following a meticulously planned strategy to persuade the public, the Congress, and the allies of the need to confront the threat of Saddam Hussein. Andrew Card, the White House chief of staff, described how the administration was stepping up its war plans for the fall. From a marketing point of view, he said, you don't introduce new products in August. This time the catchphrase for Washington's new product is not the plight of Kuwaiti people, but the assertion that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. Forget the feckless moralizing of peace lobbies, wrote Richard Perle, chairman of the Defense Policy Board. The United States will act alone if necessary and use a preemptive strike if it determines it's in U.S. interests. Weapons inspectors have conflicting reports about the status of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, and many have said clearly that its arsenal has been dismantled and that it does not have the capacity to build one. However, there is no confusion over the extent and range of America's arsenal of nuclear and chemical weapons. Would the U.S. government welcome weapons inspectors? Would the U.K. or Israel? What if Iraq does have a nuclear weapon? Does that justify a preemptive U.S. strike? The United States has the largest arsenal of nuclear weapons in the world. It's the only country in the world to have actually used them on civilian populations. If the United States is justified in launching a preemptive attack on Iraq, why then any nuclear power is justified in carrying out a preemptive attack on any other? India could attack Pakistan, or the other way around. The U.S. government develops a distaste for the Indian Prime Minister. Can it just take him out with a preemptive strike? Recently, the United States played an important part in forcing India and Pakistan back from the brink of war. Is it so hard for it to take its own advice? Who is guilty of feckless moralizing, of preaching peace while it wages war? The United States, which George Bush calls a peaceful nation, has been at war with one country or another every year for the last 50 years. Wars are never fought for altruistic reasons. They are usually fought for hegemony, for business, and then, of course, there's the business of war. Protecting its control of the world's oil is fundamental to U.S. policy. The U.S. government's recent military interventions in the Balkans and Central Asia have little to do with oil. Hamid Karzai, the puppet president of Afghanistan installed by the United States, is said to be a former employee of UNICAL, the American-based oil company. The U.S. government's paranoid patrolling of the Middle East is because it has two-thirds of the world's oil reserves. Oil keeps America's engines purring sweetly. Oil keeps the free market rolling. Whoever controls the world's oil controls the world's markets. And how do you control the oil? Nobody puts it more elegantly than the New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman in an article called The Craziness Pays. He says the U.S. has to make clear to Iraq and U.S. allies that America will use force without negotiation, hesitation, or UN approval. His advice was well taken. In the wars against Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as in the almost daily humiliation the U.S. government heaps on the U.N. In his book on globalization, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, Friedman says, the hidden hand of the market will never work without a hidden fist. McDonald's cannot flourish without McDonnell Douglas. And the hidden fist that keeps the world safe for Silicon Valley's technologies to flourish is called the U.S. Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps. Perhaps this was written in a moment of vulnerability, but it's certainly the most succinct, accurate description of the project of corporate globalization that I have read. After September 11, 2001, and the war against terror, the hidden hand and fist have had their cover blown, and we have a clear view now on America's other weapon, the free market, bearing down on the developing world with a clenched, unsmiling smile. The task that does not end is America's perfect war, the perfect vehicle for the endless expansion of American imperialism. In Urdu, the word for prophet is Veda. Al-Qaeda means the word of God, the law. So in India, some of us call the war against terror Al-Qaeda versus Al-Fayda, the word versus the prophet, no pun intended. For the moment, it looks as though Al-Fayda will carry the day, but then you never know. In the last 10 years of unbridled corporate globalization, the world's total income has increased by an average of 2.5% a year. and yet the numbers of the poor in the world has increased by 100 million. Of the top 100 biggest economies, 51 are corporations, not countries. The top 1% of the world has the same combined income as the bottom 57%, and the disparity is growing. Now, under the spreading canopy of the war against terror, this process is being hustled along. The men in suits are in an unseemly hurry. While bombs rain down on us and cruise missiles skid across the skies, while nuclear weapons are stockpiled to make the world a safer place, contracts are being signed, patents are being registered, oil pipelines are being laid, natural resources are being plundered, water is being privatized, and democracies are being undermined. In a country like India, the structural adjustment end of the corporate globalization project is ripping through people's lives. Development projects, massive privatization, and labor reforms are pushing people off their lands and out of their jobs, resulting in a kind of barbaric dispossession that has few parallels in history. Across the world, as the free market brazenly protects Western markets and forces developing countries to lift their trade barriers, the poor are getting poorer and the rich richer. Civil unrest has begun to erupt in the global village. In countries like Argentina, Brazil, Mexico, Bolivia, and India, the resistance movements against corporate globalization are growing. To contain them, governments are tightening their control. Protesters are being labeled terrorists and then being dealt with as such. But civil unrest does not only mean marches and demonstrations and protests against globalization. Unfortunately, it also means a desperate downward spiral into crime and chaos and all kinds of despair and disillusionment, which, as we know from history and from what we see unspooling before our eyes, gradually becomes a fertile breeding ground for terrible things. Cultural nationalism, religious bigotry, fascism, and, of course, terrorism. All these march arm-in-arm with corporate globalization. There is a notion gaining credence that the free market breaks down national barriers and that corporate globalization's ultimate destination is a hippie paradise where the heart is the only passport and we will all live together happily inside a John Lennon song. Imagine there's no country. This is a canard. What the free market undermines is not national sovereignty, but democracy. As the disparity between the rich and poor grows, the hidden fist has its work cut out for it. Multinational corporations on the prowl for sweetheart deals that yield enormous profits cannot push through those deals and administer those projects in developing countries without the active connivance of state machinery, the police, the courts, sometimes even the army. Today, corporate globalization needs an international confederation of loyal, corrupt, authoritarian governments in poorer countries to push through unpopular reforms and quell the mutinies. It needs a press that pretends to be free. It needs courts that pretend to dispense justice. It needs nuclear bombs, standing armies, sterner immigration laws, and watchful coastal patrols to make sure that it's only money, goods, patents, and services that are globalized. Not the free movement of people, not a respect for human rights, not international treaties on racial discrimination or chemical and nuclear weapons or greenhouse gas emissions, climate change or, God forbid, justice. It's as though even a gesture toward international accountability would wreck the whole enterprise. Close to 1 year after the war against terror was officially flagged off in the ruins of Afghanistan, freedoms are being curtailed in country after country in the name of protecting freedom. Civil liberties are being suspended in the name of protecting democracy. All kinds of defense is being defined as terrorism. All kinds of dissent is being defined as terrorism. All kinds of laws are being passed to deal with it. Osama bin Laden seems to have vanished into thin air. Mullah Omar is said to have made his escape on a motorbike. They could have sent Tintin after him. The Taliban may have disappeared, but their spirit and their system of summary justice is surfacing in the unlikeliest of places. In India, in Pakistan, in Nigeria, in America, in all the Central Asian republics run by all manner of despots, and of course in Afghanistan, under the U.S.-backed Northern Alliance. Meanwhile, down at the mall, there's a mid-season sale. Everything's discounted. Oceans, rivers, oil, gene pools, fig wasps, flowers, childhoods, aluminum factories, phone companies, wisdom, wilderness, civil rights, ecosystems, air, all 4.6 billion years of evolution. It's packed, sealed, tagged, valued, and available off the rack. No returns. As for justice, I'm told it's on offer, too. You can get the best that money can buy. Donald Rumsfeld said that his mission in the war against terror was to persuade the world that Americans must be allowed to continue their way of life. When the maddened king stamps his foot, slaves tremble in their quarters. So, standing here today, it's hard for me to say this, but the American way of life is simply not sustainable because it doesn't acknowledge that there is a world beyond America. I'm going to say that again. The American way of life is simply not sustainable because it does not acknowledge that there is a world beyond America. Fortunately, power has a shelf life. When the time comes, maybe this mighty empire will, like others before it, overreach itself and implode from it within. It looks as though structural cracks have already appeared. As the war against terror casts its net wider and wider, America's corporate heart is hemorrhaging. For all the endless empty chatter about democracy, today the world is run by three of the most secretive institutions in the world: the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the World Trade Organization, all three of which in turn are dominated by the United States. Their decisions are made in secret. The people who heed them are appointed behind closed doors. Nobody really knows anything about them, their politics, their beliefs, their intentions. Nobody elected them. Nobody said they could make decisions on our behalf. A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody's elected can't possibly last. Soviet-style communism failed not because it was intrinsically evil, but because it was flawed. It allowed too few people to usurp too much power. 21st century market capitalism, American style, will fail for the same reasons. Both are edifices constructed by human intelligence, undone by human nature. The time has come, the walrus said. Perhaps things will get worse and then better. Perhaps there's a small god up in heaven readying herself for us. Another world is not only possible, she's on her way. Maybe many of us won't be here to greet her, but on a quiet day, if I listen very carefully, I can hear her breathing. Erin Dottie Roy from the essay Come September in her book War Talk. That ends our program today. Thanks so much for the few people that were able to get through. Tomorrow is going to be completely call-ins and out to people marching in the United for Peace and Justice, United for Peace and Justice march that's happening. People are gathering at 10 a.m. The march begins at noon. You can call me at 917-414-0276 and tell me what you are seeing, what you're seeing and experiencing at the march. I thank everybody who participated in today's program and who has been to visit the exhibition. Thanks so much and goodbye.